Welcome, I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is your call's One Planet series. In recent months, we have seen a number of high-profile reports warning of a looming climate crisis if we keep relying on fossil fuels as our source of energy. Last October, a major report by the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change warned that without a massive shift away from a fossil fuel-based economy in the next decade, we are going to experience more severe droughts, mass migrations, famine, and flooding. And that news was followed by another report by 13 federal agencies warning about the consequences of climate change for the United States, the second biggest polluter in the world. And last week, another study concluded that the oceans are warming faster than ever. But amid mounting calls to phase out fossil fuels in order to stop this climate crisis, the United States is now ramping up its oil and gas drilling faster than any other country in the world. A new report by the advocacy group Oil Change International and 17 partner organizations reveals that the administration's policies could unleash the largest burst of new carbon emissions in the world between now and 2050. And by 2030, the U.S. is on track to produce 60% of the world's new oil and gas supply. So how fast is the Trump administration expanding oil and gas production? And what are the challenges to the administration's energy policies that might end up keeping this fuel in the ground? Joining me to discuss this issue is Cassie Siegel, Senior Counsel and Climate Law Institute Director for the Center for Biological Diversity, one of the organizations that collaborated with Oil Exchange International on their latest report titled Drilling Towards Disaster, Why U.S. Oil and Gas Expansion is Incompatible with Climate Limits. And she joins us by Skype from Joshua Tree. Welcome, Cassie.
Good morning, Ethan.
Good morning. And we're also joined by Antonia Juhas, a leading author and investigative journalist covering the oil industry. She has written extensively on the influence of big oil and the intersection between oil companies and the U.S. government. She's the author of three books, including her most recent, Black Tide, The Devastating Impact of the Gulf Oil Spill. And she joins us in the studio. Welcome back, Antonia.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Glad you both can be here. And Antonia, I wanted to start with you. So it's clear that the Trump administration has used and continues to use everything in its arsenal to expand oil and gas production, particularly on public lands, as we'll discuss. And the report that I just mentioned by the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has now given the public a new sense of urgency, with potentially just a dozen years for global action in order for us to do everything we can to keep warming to a maximum 1.5 degrees Celsius increase, beyond which even half a degree could have catastrophic consequences for the whole planet. So I wanted to ask you, are you alarmed by this UN IPCC report? And is there any new information in it that you find particularly concerning?
I'm certainly alarmed by it. There was new information and a bringing together and reanalyzing of existing information. The data that we have on the impacts of a warming climate on our environment and on the Earth are constantly changing, and primarily for the worse. So every year that we get a new study and every month that we get a new study, they're important to look at because new data is coming in and the data is changing and the impacts on the Earth are changing. So it's very important to always look at this new information. But then what was particularly unique about this United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change analysis was that it was a report that was asked for by the parties when they signed on to the Paris Climate Accord in 2015, asking the IPCC to investigate what would it mean if the planet, if warming happened faster than 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels per year. And the reason for that request was because at the Paris Climate Accord negotiations, the agreement looks at just a two degrees Celsius warming above pre-industrial levels. And the most impacted communities around the world already, which is almost all of us at this point, but those hurt the most, already feeling the worst impacts of climate change in terms of floods, in terms of hurricanes, in terms of droughts, in terms of losing their home, were adamant in Paris and were staging protests and were demanding that 2 degrees Celsius of warming is too much. We're already suffering too severe of impacts. We need to look at 1.5 degrees Celsius. And this report responded to those demands. And this report found that if we don't hold the world to 1.5 degrees Celsius warming, we may pass a precipice at 12 years beyond which stabilization of the climate is not possible. And that was what was so important about this finding, that 12 years is basically saying we have 12 years to change our policies, to change our behavior, to make it possible to stabilize warming. If we don't, we can expect much worse of what we're already experiencing. And that means much more frequent drought, fire, floods, hurricanes, the instability that that creates, the conflict that that creates, the forced migration and immigration of people around the world having to leave places that are suffering the consequences of these events to try to find other places to live. But the good news, let me just really quickly, the good news about the report is it said that we can do this. And that's the really important other piece, that we have it within our capacity to do this.
So that's a hopeful way to sort of frame what is otherwise a dire picture that it sounds like the scientists that the UN is working with have really basically come to a consensus on. Now, given that this is a dire picture, what have you seen the response be here in the United States, and particularly with the oil and gas industry, given that the implications of this report is that we would have to keep more of their product in the ground and curtail the profits that they're making?
I think the most important harmful response was that delivered by the Trump administration itself. This report was released in Poland at the most recent United Nations climate negotiations that were being held to put in place the mechanisms for how to implement the commitments made at the Paris Climate Accord. And what the Trump administration did was really debut what has been a coalescing of an alliance that has begun in an entirely new way with the Trump administration, which is an alliance between Trump, Putin, and Saudi Arabia, so Russia, the United States, and Saudi Arabia, to really forge a commitment to make sure that the world remains committed to fossil fuels broadly, but oil in particular, because that's the resource that really drives these three countries. And they stood in Poland with Kuwait to block the findings of this report. So this report, which was asked for by the United Nations, by the Paris countries, they joined together to block the findings. And that was really indicative of the position of the Trump administration, but also this, as I said, I think very dangerous alliance being formed by these nations to try to push back as aggressively as possible on a movement to really address climate change. And instead, what the Trump administration is doing is moving aggressively in the opposite direction, as you've laid out. But of course, the Trump administration doesn't define entirely what's happening in the United States in response to things like the IPCC report, because across the United States, what we're seeing are poll numbers dramatically shifting as people experience the impacts of climate change themselves and have the language and the information with which to identify those events as climate-induced events. They not only believe in record numbers, including Republicans, the majority of which now firmly acknowledge the reality of climate change, but the polls also say they want to take action to address it.
So the administration sounds like they're increasingly out of step with where their own voters here in the U.S. hopefully are on this issue in terms of accepting the science around climate. So, Cassie, let me bring you into this discussion. Given that the U.S. is the second largest polluter in the world, what are the consequences of this U.S. energy policy for the planet as a whole that we're seeing right now with the Trump administration and historically to date?
The consequence is that every new fossil fuel project approval pushes us further towards catastrophe. And I think the most important thing for people to know about fossil fuel production is that globally, we already have enough oil, gas, and coal in already open producing fields to blow way past 1.5 degrees. So we know that 1.5 degrees is the critical guardrail that we need to stay below. And we know that there's already enough fossil fuel fields open to blow through that. So the implication is there is no room in our carbon budget for any new oil, gas, or coal development. And in fact, we need to shut down most of the world's existing fields before they're fully depleted. And the Trump administration, of course, is taking us in exactly the opposite direction. It's like we, as a society, are in a bus speeding towards the edge of a cliff, and the Trump administration has floored it. And what we need to do is stop that and hit the brakes. And we do that by ending new fossil fuel project approvals and by committing to a thoughtful plan to phase out existing extraction at the same time as we decarbonize our economy overall.
And so, Cassie, how critical is the U.S. to all of this? I mean, does all this hinge on whether or not the U.S. can keep its reserves in the ground, or is this something that needs to be solved globally, or that could be solved in spite of what the Trump administration is doing in the short term here?
Yeah, it absolutely hinges on the U.S., and this is a U.S. problem, and specifically, it is a fracked oil and gas problem in the U.S. And between now and mid-century, if nothing is done, the U.S. alone would be responsible for 60% in global oil and gas growth. And that's like a new fleet of 1,000 power plants coming online. And we can't do that. If we continue down that path, then literally life as we know it will end, because the extreme weather and sea level rise, drought, heat waves, fires, all these things which we are already experiencing will become so much worse.
Well, let's talk about some of the oil and gas exploration that happens in the U.S., particularly offshore oil drilling. And Antonio, I wanted to start with you. Last week marked 50 years since the most disastrous oil spill in California history. In 1969, the oil spill in Santa Barbara spewed 3 million gallons of crude oil into the Pacific Ocean. And since 1969, California has not issued new leases for offshore drilling, but the old ones are still operational. So what lessons do you think we've learned from that spill now 50 years on?
Yeah, and of course, at that time, the worst spill, surpassed it with several events, including the BP Deepwater Horizon disaster in 2010. We learned a lot of really important lessons from the Santa Barbara oil spill in 1969. I think one of the most important ones for listeners to take in now is that what people did in response to the oil spill was a lot of mass organizing, and many people attribute that spill to the birth of the environmental movement within the United States. And I think the biggest ultimate outcome was a recognition that just because we have oil resources and natural gas resources doesn't mean it's the best decision to go after them. And so one of the most significant outcomes of the oil spill was a push to put in place moratoriums on drilling for oil and natural gas in federal waters off the United States. And that happened through congressional mandate and then through presidential mandate under the first Bush administration. So we put in place a moratorium that said, we know there's oil and gas in the federal waters off California, off the Pacific, across the Atlantic, in the Arctic, off the coast of Florida. But we're going to decide that it's not worth the costs to allow oil companies to drill it, even though they want to. And these moratoriums were put in place. We left, sadly, as a national sacrifice zone, the Gulf of Mexico and parts of Alaska. And we left in place existing drilling in state waters off the coast of California, and the moratorium was just on new leasing. But though that moratorium held for a very significant period of time, and it was finally eradicated in 2008, unfortunately, but drilling didn't take place in most of those places nonetheless, because the public didn't want drilling to take place in most of those places nonetheless. And it's still now with the Trump administration, even though the moratoriums aren't in place, that drilling hasn't happened. And the Trump administration is the one that's trying to put in place a new drilling plan that would open 96% of federal waters to offshore drilling and start issuing permits in those areas. And what that tells us is that we can and have made decisions as a people to decide that it's not worthwhile to go after resources even though we have them. And we, for example, the Obama administration most recently had put in place a moratorium on any new coal leasing on public lands. And that was taken away by the Trump administration. And shortly thereafter, the Trump administration started opening up new leasing, really in unprecedented levels on public lands of coal, of oil, of natural gas. And for the first time in 6 years, at the end of 2017, the U.S. reversed what had been a downward trend on coal production and is now on an upward trend in coal production. And that's entirely as a result of eliminating that restriction that had been put in place by the Obama administration and making a decision to drill. And the Trump administration has been making that decision on public lands to a profound degree, doubling the amount of land, increasing the amount of public land available to oil and natural gas drilling by six times over what it was 2 years ago. As a result, the number of oil and natural gas wells on lands administered by the Interior Department increased by an astounding 85% from 2016 to 2017. So this is a reversal of an approach that the United States had been taking, which was to not only maintain areas of public lands, to have them not open to oil and gas, but to actually put in place restrictions on where we can drill. And that's the direction that we need to be re-embracing as a nation. It's not a radical idea being thrown out by radicals. It's a re-embracing of policy that we've already held on to in the United States.
Well, and I would note that there was bipartisan opposition from many of the Republican governors along the coast to proposed offshore drilling resuming in some of these waters. So it's clearly not just a radical issue. But you mentioned that there are these drilling rigs that have predated this moratorium. Is there any hope to decommission those rigs and prevent that drilling from continuing?
I'll pass that over to Cassie, because I know that that's work that the Center for Biological Diversity is working on.
Well, Cassie, what's your take on the hope for decommissioning those existing rigs offshore?
Yeah, there absolutely is. And in fact, some platforms off the coast of California have been shut down ever since the Plains All-American pipeline disaster in 2015, when there was a big spill. A lot of oil made it to the ocean, and they are trying to reopen those. They have made a variety of proposals from trucking the oil up the California coast to currently proposing to rebuild the pipeline. There is massive public opposition to that, and I think platforms that are closed now will stay closed, and we need a plan to shut down and decommission these things. It's just an absolute imperative. The government can absolutely do it. And, the number one thing, though, most common sense, no-brainer thing, is for the U.S. government to stop selling off new publicly owned oil, gas, and coal to fossil fuel polluters for development. That's what these lease sales are. I mean, some oil, gas, and coal is publicly owned by the federal government. The federal government needs to keep it that way. I mean, when you're in a hole, the first thing you do is stop digging. And so that's why hundreds of organizations petitioned the Obama administration in 2016 to stop those leases, both onshore and offshore. Obama took some good, albeit small, steps in that direction with the coal moratorium, with the withdrawal of the Arctic Ocean and portions of the Atlantic Ocean from leasing at the end of his term. And we're now in court fighting over the Trump administration's attempts to restart that. But ending new leasing and ending subsidies for the fossil fuel companies are just the first and most obvious steps that the next minute.
And Kathy, let's talk about some of the state level policies, because we talked a bit about what the federal government can do on public lands offshore, et cetera. But here in California, we know that the state is looked to as a leader in fighting climate change. But during Governor Brown's 8-year two terms in office, more than 200 new wells were initiated in state waters, more than 23,000 oil and gas drilling permits overall. So how do you make sense of these contradictory policies that we have here in the state? And do you expect that it will be any different under our new governor, Gavin Newsom?
Well, the way to make sense of it is that things need to change. It is simply not possible to be a climate leader while approving permits for 23,000 new oil wells, which is what Governor Brown did. And with this whole suite of new reports, new information that we have really since the Paris climate talks, it is now the consensus that we need to address both the consumption of fossil fuels, but also their production. And for some reason, for the past 30 years, and it's no accident, it's because of lobbying by the fossil fuel producers and their great power, we have had politicians say, we will do climate policy and only look at one side of the coin. If we just take some steps to incentivize electric cars and, you know, start using less oil in the transportation sector, then that fossil fuel production stuff, that'll take care of itself. That doesn't make any sense. I mean, when you think about other environmental problems that we try to solve, you address both their consumption and their production. I mean, you know, if you say, oh, well, we're going to say you can't use asbestos in construction anymore in homes, or we can't use CFCs, but we'll just let manufacturers continue to produce as much as they want of it, you know that's not going to be successful, right? You have to go after both pieces. Activists have long understood that, and politicians are starting to, but it is just absolutely essential that California plug the gaping hole in its climate policy by addressing its own dirty oil and gas extraction.
Well, do you see that? Mm-hmm. So I've heard Governor Brown make this political argument, and I'm wondering if you can see the logic here, that it's important first to have the alternative to oil and gas kind of viable and relatively low cost with things like electric vehicles in order to get that political support you need to then tamp down on the supply. I mean, do you see the political logic there, or do you think that the politics are actually there to implement a ban on new drilling, a ban on and maybe decommissioning existing drilling in our current political climate?
That political logic has been dominating policy for 30 years. And in the mid-1990s, it was a little bit more tenable to make that argument, but it's been proven unsuccessful. And one of the main reasons for that is the massive power of fossil fuel polluters through their disinformation campaigns, through taking their vast profits and investing them in blocking stronger measures to address climate change in California and at the federal level. They are holding us back. And we know just from a physical and climate math perspective, we need to start leaving fossil fuels in the ground. And from a political perspective, we also need to do that. Government, federal government, state governments, governments around the world need to start saying no to the fossil fuel industry and letting them control everything. I mean, that is just, it's absolutely essential. So, and finally, you know, the technology has been here for decades. The passenger fleet, for example, cars and trucks, that is the low-hanging fruit. It is not technology holding us back. It's political opposition. And so this is the important message. We have 12 years to act. We have to take this, you know, the failed political rationalizations of the past, set them aside, get to work on a really transformative, bold measures that are going to work and that are going to make the world a safer, more equitable place for everybody.
All right. Well, this is your call. We're discussing the Trump administration's energy policies and the prospects of keeping fossil fuels in the ground. And we'll be back after this short break.
Chris Christie, down but not out.
Is Steve Bannon mistaken or is he lying?
No, he's lying. This is not a guy who plays well in the sandbox with others.
Former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie talks to Joshua Johnson about fibs, presidential friendships, and his style of in-your-face politics. That's next time on 1A.
1/2 hour from now, 1A here on KALW. This is your call on KALW, local public radio. If you have a perspective you haven't heard in today's discussion or a question that you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255, toll free. You can also send an email to yourcall@kalw.org or post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org, or tweet us at yourcallradio.
All right, for those of you joining us just now, I'm Ethan Elkind, subbing in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. We are podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up next. And if you have a show idea for us, you can drop us a line at yourcall@kalw.org or call us at 866-798-8255 or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. Well, this morning we're discussing the Trump administration's energy policy. According to the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the world needs to cut carbon emissions nearly in half by 2030 to keep global warming within 1.5 degrees Celsius. But the U.S. is expanding its oil and gas drilling more than any other country in the world, potentially unleashing 120 billion tons of new carbon pollution. So what's being done to stop this climate disaster? Well, we're joined by two experts, Cassie Siegel, Senior Counsel and Climate Law Institute Director for the Center for Biological Diversity, one of the organizations that collaborated with Oil Exchange International in their latest report titled Drilling Towards Disaster, Why U.S. Oil and Gas Expansion is Incompatible with Climate Limits. And we're also joined by Antonia Juhas, a leading author and investigative journalist covering the oil industry. She has written extensively on the influence of big oil and the intersection between oil companies and the U.S. government. She's the author of 3 books, including her most recent, Black Tide, The Devastating Impact of the Gulf Oil Spill. Well, we also want to hear from you, our listeners. What can consumers do to decarbonize our economy? What are you doing to lessen your dependence on fossil fuels? And what questions might you have for our guests? You can join the conversation by dialing 866-798-8255. That's 1-866-798-TALK. Or you can email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. You can also post your comments and questions on our website at yourcallradio.org. Well, Antonia, I wanted to follow up on something we were talking about just before the break in terms of what California can do to try to limit extraction in the state. What is your take on the steps the state can take, and is there an opportunity here for our new governor, Gavin Newsom, to lead on this issue?
Yeah, and I think it's really important to look at where the role that California can play as a unique fossil fuel producer and economy. So I actually think that it's important all over the world to look at implementing policies that keep fossil fuels in the ground. And that's just following the science that we've been told. And actually, if you go back looking at ExxonMobil's own science, so ExxonMobil, we learned through some great investigative journalism and many lawsuits, knew back as early as the 1970s that the burning of fossil fuels harmed the climate and would be detrimental to the climate and to the populace. And they also learned as early as the 1970s their own estimates that were about 80% of fossil fuels would need to stay in the ground to avert the worst of climate catastrophe. They decided to sit on that information and not only sit on it, but fund climate change denialism. But that reality back in the 1970s that 80% of fossil fuels would need to stay in the ground is a number that actually has stuck quite solidly with investigations. And now, as Cassie said, we realize moving forward now 30 years that we have to get to a place where existing fossil fuels stay in the ground. And the way that that is approached is by looking at managed decline. So how do we best conscientiously decide now to start moving to implement policies that keep fossil fuels in the ground in those places where the fuels are already being produced? And where are the places that can most ethically start taking action most rapidly? And that really means places where there's already alternative economic models in place to support that state. For example, if you're talking about California, there's already wealth in that state to support a transition, meaning putting in place right away those policies that you've suggested that we need. Much more investment in public transportation, much more investment in localized provision of energy and transportation, agricultural models, cities that are already really conducive for walking and taking public transportation, all those policies that make it much more easier for more people to use less fossil fuels. And in that list, California really rises to the top of a place where we can start looking now at what's described as, I think the best terminology is the just transition to keeping fossil fuels in the ground, which is how do we do this also equitably, looking at workers and communities that are more dependent on fossil fuels and how to help shift them to renewable sources of energy and other economic models. And again, California rises to the fore. We are the fourth largest oil producing state in the country, yet we are an economy that is almost not at all dependent on that fossil fuel. It's less than 1% of our GDP is based on oil. So we can really, and we're obviously a state that really values seeing ourselves as a leader, addressing climate change, embracing renewable energy and alternatives to fossil fuels. And I do think there's a real opening with Gavin Newsom in an Oil Change International report. You mentioned Oil Change before. They have this quote that Gavin Newsom gave in February 2018. And he said, "The fossil fuel era is ending and California is not interested in the boom or bust oil economy." And that is a really good depiction of hopefully where he's headed. And there's basically what we want to do is put in place, see policies put in place that stop the new development of fields. And one really good way of doing that is starting by looking at where is the most damage currently being done by fossil fuel production in the state? And that's looking at Kern County in Los Angeles, where the majority of production, vast majority, takes place, and who's being harmed. So if you look at the communities of color that are predominantly near where that production takes place, they're facing right now extreme public health hardship by living near fossil fuel production. So one thing we can do to start is simply make the existing production safer for those who live near it. And that's creating setbacks which say we don't want to see production taking place within a certain distance from where people live. And if you start there by moving production back from the places where people live, you would start to already remove a significant amount of the production that's taking place in the state without really seeing negative economic harm on the state's overall GDP. And when you also look at where how California is being used right now as an oil and gas producer, a lot of what we're doing is refining product that comes in from somewhere else, and then we refine it, and then we ship it back out. So something else we can do is look at how much we're refining, why we're refining it. Do we want to also act as this sort of washing machine for oil? Some of it comes from our state, but a lot of it, 50% of it, comes from somewhere else. Actually, 50% of it is foreign sources of oil, and another about 20% comes from Alaska. And look at what our refineries are doing. Do we really want our refineries being this place where oil comes in, it gets refined, it gets shipped out? And what does that do, again, to the communities that live where the refineries operate? And how can we better their health and their public health by shifting how much refining actually takes place at our refineries and where and how that product is used?
So lots of options here in the state to try to limit fossil fuel extraction and production and emissions. And, you know, you mentioned Kern County. That's an interesting county for those of you who have traveled through it, Bakersfield down there in Southern California. It's one of the renewable energy leaders in the state, but as you mentioned, also one of the leaders on oil and gas exploration. So really kind of an interesting dynamic down there. Well, I want to go to one of our listeners. We have Greg from Redwood City calling in. Greg, welcome to your call.
Good morning. I just want to say, you know, listening to the conversation, I understand the front that your guests are taking, but, you know, I just recently formed a nonprofit to plant trees, and so I've been working kind of on the ground level with a lot of consumers, and, you know, Google is giving me $10,000 a month to advertise on their platform, and I post, you know, tons of ads and get, like, zero response. It's, you know, they can put in there things like climate change, and it'll tell you how many people are searching for those topics in a month or in a certain geographic area, and it's astonishingly low. So, I mean, I understand that you want to, you know, have a policy discussion, but the reality is if our public is not, you know, on fire about this, they're not going to elect people that are going to do something about this. They're going to spend money on this. And, you know, at the ground level, if you're going to, you know, talk about stopping, you know, fossil fuels from coming out of ground, and it's going to make, you know, gasoline more expensive or heating your house more expensive, consumers are not going to be on board. We need to give consumers a pathway away from fossil fuels. And then also, they will elect people that will do something to improve their livelihood. But you have to give them a pathway.
All right. So, Greg, an important question there in terms of the politics here. Cassie, let me start with you, and then Antonio will let you weigh in. But, Cassie, what's your response to Greg's political point here?
Yeah, so I think the missing component there is that, like, all other things are not equal in the policy debate, right? Like, we've had a multi-decade, multi-million-dollar disinformation campaign by the fossil fuel polluters, and the political power they have is absolutely astronomical. And it doesn't mean that people can't win, particularly at the local level. When people get together and organize to take that power back, they can. But this is not a level playing field. And so we need some elected leaders, starting with the governor of California, starting with the next president, to say, you know what, the government needs to act. Like, this is not a problem that we're going to solve with consumer behavior alone. And in fact, the fossil fuel polluters, part of their disinformation campaign now, you know, they are pivoting from hard climate denial to this more subtle and in some ways even more insidious argument that it's really, you know, it's everybody's fault. It's a consumer problem. But you know what? Their advocacy and their lies have taken choices away from people because they've blocked for decades the policies that would have moved us in the right direction. So we would have been so much further down the clean energy road right now. And we know what we need to do. California is the world's fifth largest economy. It must become the climate leader that the rest of the world needs it to be. And it's pretty simple. The state needs to stop approving new fossil fuel projects, no permits for new wells, no new pipelines, no oil refinery expansions. The state needs to put in a health and safety buffer zone of no less than half a mile around where people live, because we have extensive neighborhood drilling in California. It's shocking and people are sick. And as Antonio said so well, we need to commit to a just transition plan to phase out the extraction that's already going on here. We're support to the communities that have been most affected, to the affected workers. We're talking about things like wage replacement, like healthcare coverage, like job retraining. You know, we should be providing a social safety net for people in all industries, which, you know, does not happen under our system. These corporations throw people out of work all the time for reasons that have to do with nothing but their profits. But we can do this, and we, you know, it is important. You know, education of the public is important, but we know enough for our elected leaders to act now, and we just simply have to demand that they do it.
And Antonio, did you want to weigh in with any additional thoughts for,
yeah,
in response to Greg's point?
Yeah, Greg raised a lot of really important issues, and I'm really glad that he did. So one that I think is critically important is this idea that if we reduce oil production in California, our gasoline prices are going to go up. And that is a myth that is not even close to being borne out by the data. So I had a really fun day because I'm a data nerd going through this data to create a chart that shows, if you look at the state of California, we've been in a decline in our oil production since 1985, a steady decline. Now, if gasoline prices followed that production, then gasoline prices would have been on an equal steady incline going up since 1985. That's not at all what's happened. Instead, gasoline prices in California have an up and down trajectory that looks like it's not straight. It's up and down, it's up and down, it's up and down. It follows precisely the model of gasoline prices for the entire nation. And they move identically together, up and down, up and down, up and down, but with California's gasoline prices higher than the nation's. And then he put in another price index, and that's the international price of oil, and the three of those things move exactly together. The way the movement of the price of oil dictates the movement predominantly, not exclusively, the movement of the price of gasoline in the state, and it is not remotely tied to the amount of oil that we produce within the state of California. And in fact, one of the major factors that's impacting the volatility of the price of oil globally is climate change. It's massive climate disruptions that are hitting places that produce and refine and transport oil, which is making it very difficult for people who trade in oil to adequately predict or even manipulate, which I argue that they do, the price. And so actually climate change is a more significant driver of fluctuations in the price of oil. But none of it has anything to do with how much oil we produce in our state. So we can continue that decline, but move it more rapidly and not necessarily, and certainly not see a guaranteed increase in the price of gasoline prices. In fact, we've seen the price of gasoline prices increase and electricity prices increase in the last 2 years as the Trump administration has been dramatically increasing production of oil, natural gas, and coal. So even increased production of these resources has not meant a decline in gasoline or electricity. In fact, they've moved in the opposite direction. So I think it's really important to challenge that that myth. And then another piece that we didn't bring in that Greg is forcing us to address, which is really critically important, is that there is activism, strong activism on climate change, and it has been pushed to a very significant factor impacting elections. And that's why so many elected officials have signed on to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's push, and now Senator Markey, who's joining on this week, push for a Green New Deal. There is tremendous activism and support behind action on climate change, elected officials who will act on it and implement policy to enforce it. And I think the Green New Deal is a really key part of that. Unfortunately, the Green New Deal does not, at this stage, at least. So Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Senator Markey are introducing a Green New Deal likely as early as this week. What we've seen of drafts is that it doesn't explicitly include language, unfortunately, on the necessity of keeping fossil fuels in the ground. And hopefully that can change as the policy gets developed. And one reason for that, and let me just add this one last piece. I just recently completed a year and a half long investigation that I wrote for Pacific Standard Magazine, looking at how dangerous oil and gas jobs are, and looking at the building of pipelines that carry oil and natural gas and development in the field. And I actually ran the numbers for pipelines for the first time, finding that these are among the most dangerous jobs in the nation, building the pipelines. And then, as has already been made clear in data after data for years, oil and gas production as well. And that if we include in a new infrastructure bill significant amounts of money for the building and refurbishing of water infrastructure in the United States and pipelines, which is so vital. Let's just remember, how dangerous water pipelines have been to cities in the United States. Those are jobs that are completely 100% transferable. If you're someone who builds a pipeline that carries oil and natural gas, you can build a much safer pipeline that carries water instead and have a good unionized job, but carry a resource that's much better for yourself and better for the planet.
So lots of interesting things to think about in terms of the politics of this and how labor comes into play and safety, et cetera. Well, I want to thank Greg for that question, and then I want to go to another caller, Mark in San Leandro. Welcome to your call.
Thank you so much. I would point out that in today's New York Times, there's a feature story, front page, heralding the United States becoming the major supplier of crude oil. And they cite the Permian Basin, which I'm sure your experts there know all about. And there's not, it goes on for pages, and there's not one mention of climate change, not one mention of keep it in the ground. In fact, the whole thing is celebratory. Here we are, and we're beating everybody to the punch. So that's a, clearly a problem.
So, all right, Mark, thank you for bringing that that up. And Cassie, let me direct that one to you. Are you familiar with what Mark's discussing and any reactions to it?
Yeah, I am. I read that article this morning, and it is super, super, super weird that there is nothing about climate change in that article. I don't know what's up with that, if it's editing process or what. But the Permian Basin in New Mexico and Texas is the number one source of fracked oil and gas that is pushing us towards disaster. So the projected growth in U.S. oil and gas production is four times greater in this country than any other country between now and mid-century, and the largest of all is the Permian Basin. We simply have to stop and reverse that. I mean, the explosion of fracked oil is predictable from the legal loopholes, from the Halliburton loophole going forward that enabled and promoted fracking in this country, from the lifting of the 40-year ban on crude oil exports at the end of 2015. And, you know, those were the radical changes in decreasing environmental protection and in incentivizing this stuff. And we simply have to have the government start placing limits on it so we can stay below 1.5 degrees. That's our imperative. And to have an article like that in the New York Times that doesn't mention it is just super weird.
Yeah, all right. Well, it sounds like you two are in agreement on that. Maybe it's a time for a letter to the editor of the New York Times on that piece. Well, thank you, Mark, for that question. I want to go back to the phones. We have Harvey calling in from Berkeley. Harvey, welcome to your call.
Hi there. Thanks for the show. Well, it turns out that we know that fracking poisons our freshwater aquifers, but even worse still, we know that fracking causes earthquakes, and offshore fracking in particular could trigger an earthquake along the many, many fault lines. And of course, we know that the San Andreas fault line is connected to the Huascari fault line. The Huascari fault line is connected to the shoreline fault line, and the shoreline fault line is connected to the Diablo Cove fault, which runs right underneath the Diablo nuclear power plant. And so fracking could actually trigger a Fukushima-like meltdown at the Diablo Cove nuclear power plant, and so that would and that sits in front of the California Central Growing Valley, and the coastal winds blow inland, so it would irradiate all the clouds, would rise up and irradiate all the food in the Central Valley. So fracking for oil and gas could really be the end of California.
So Harvey, you're definitely raising some serious alarms there in terms of what may happen with seismic impacts. And Cassie, has Center for Biological Diversity been monitoring the risks of earthquakes? I know that you're out there, your organization's out there litigating some of these different projects. What is your response to this concern around seismic impacts?
It is absolutely a serious concern. We have seen induced earthquakes around the country and around the world, not just from the fracking itself, but even more frequently from the re-injection underground of the vast quantities of toxic waste fluid that come with oil and gas production. And we do not have in California, shockingly, a system in place that is capable of properly monitoring and tracking induced earthquakes from oil and gas activity. So that is one of the many, many safety problems with these ultra-hazardous techniques. And, nationwide, fracking is the number one technique. It will be used for 90% of projected oil and gas extraction nationally. In California, the situation is more complex. We have fracking, we have acidization, we have other ultra-hazardous techniques like steam injection, steam flooding, water flooding going on here. And the bottom line is we have to stop approving the new stuff. We have to make a plan to phase out this existing, dirty, dangerous industry and transition to clean energy, safer jobs, and cleaner air and water.
And Cassie, just last word here. We only have about a minute or so left. Do you expect to see action from the legislature and the governor in the next few months on this?
We certainly are very optimistic. As you noted, now Governor Newsom did some great things as Lieutenant Governor and in his capacity on the State Lands Commission. And less than 30 days into the administration, we don't have too much information yet, but we sure are optimistic.
All right. And Antonia, 30 seconds, what do you see coming up in the next few months on this issue, if anything?
I think the place to look right now is this development of the Green New Deal and both supporting the vital necessity of a Green New Deal and making sure that it includes the necessity of keeping fossil fuels in the ground and implementing the most just transition possible to that outcome.
All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it there. This is Your Call. We've been discussing the Trump administration's energy policies and the prospects for keeping oil and gas in the ground to avert the climate crisis. I want to thank our guests, Cassie Siegel, Senior Counsel and Climate Law Institute Director for the Center for Biological Diversity, where she develops and implements campaigns for the reduction of greenhouse gas pollution and the protection of plants and animals threatened by global warming. Thank you, Cassie, for joining us.
Thank you so much for having this important show, Ethan. It's been a pleasure.
And I also want to thank Antonia Yuhas, a leading author and investigative journalist covering the oil industry, including the most recent book, Black Tide, The Devastating Impact of the Gulf Oil Spill. Thank you, Antonia, for joining us as well.
Thanks for having me. And I just want to tell listeners they can look at my Los Angeles Times piece in December outlining the Trump administration's policies. Thank you for having me.
Sure, and we'll post that on the website as well. Coming up tomorrow on Your Call, we'll hear from grassroots organizations that are keeping their neighborhoods safe when existing services aren't enough. Community medics are training one another to respond to emergency before ambulances can. Violence interrupters in cities around the country are working to contain street violence when it flares up and to put an end to gun violence in the long term. How are citizens organizing to meet the needs of their communities? You can join the next Your Call tomorrow with Renee Kemp and you. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. You can also find us on iTunes, where you can give us a review. Follow us on Twitter at yourcallradio and email show ideas and feedback to yourcall@kalw.org. Malia Hay-Razazan produced today's show. Josh Wilner is our social media producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Thanks for joining us. I'm Ethan Elkind sitting in for Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.